this wonderful, challenging, terrible topic. in a way. How many were here last time? Right. And how many who were here last time did some inquiry in the last week? Did some looking, as I was suggesting. Great. And how many are here for the first time today, at least in this series? Yeah, not the first time in the group, but the first time. We're not. How many were not here last time? Very good. Okay. So I'll give a bit of a review from last time, and then take us a little further. And my hope is to a little bit of feedback. Do I have this a little bit too close, do you think?
No, usually it's because it's too far away rather than too
okay.
close.
Okay. I'd like to leave a significant amount of room for us talking together and sharing some what might have been noticed, explored, questions that came up, and so forth. So a little bit of a review first from last time. It's a large issue, this question of race and racism and how it connects with our practice. And like other larger collective issues, whether they have to do with ecological issues or more questions of justice around race or gender or economics, there is a question that can arise as to why this is part of our practice. And there is, as I mentioned last time, there can be a prevailing model that our practice is about coming to greater peace and calm and understanding, and it's essentially something that we do on our own. And where does attention to these larger issues come in? It's a very real question. I brought up a number of ways to look at that question. I cited last time Bhikkhu Bodhi, the major translator of the Pali Canon, who talked about how often Buddhist practice is understood in a kind of middle-class framework of just attending to where we're kind of frustrated by life or where things aren't good. That's how dukkha or suffering is understood, without really necessarily attending to the larger suffering of the world. And I also quoted Gary Snyder, writing some 50 years ago, talking about how in Asia as well, Buddhism was often primarily focused on the existential dimensions of suffering, our own personal confusion and our not being able to see the larger nature of things, the nature of our own mind, the nature of tendencies to grasp and push away, and the relationship between that and our own well-being. And how, in the Snyder reading, he claimed, again, some 50 years ago, that historically Buddhists were very willing, particularly those in some authority, to make peace with the tyrannies of their own societies. And he took that as an issue, and he said that he was suggesting that something new will likely come about in the West, because we have these traditions of social action. We have, we live in a country which was started with a revolution. We have traditions of people having power as citizens to affect their society. That is not an understanding which has existed in most societies, which had pre-established hierarchies generally, and things were as they were because that's how they were. Right? And there's some, so I think Snyder was saying, there's something different that may be coming about in our time. And I think we know that as Buddhism has moved to different countries, there's always a kind of meeting of the essence of practice with the rich traditions of the countries where Buddhism goes. We can see that in Tibet, in Southeast Asia, in China, in Japan. Zen is there because Buddhist practice merges with kind of the indigenous Taoist tradition, you know, with a very playful quality that wasn't always there in Indian Buddhism. And so I would say that one of our horizons is that we are in a way finding a map of awakening that is appropriate for our times and for our conditioning. And that this involves, and again, this is debatable, this is something I'm not asking you to take on faith, but that the part of the creativity and innovation, as well as some of the challenges, have to do with there being a horizon that's opening up that's a little bit different from the prevailing model that was there at the beginning, as Buddhism came to the West, and it was, okay, do this retreat, meditate, and so forth. So I think that's part of what's happening here, and that kind of gives the wider framework for looking at race or racism, as well as a host of other questions, again, which I think we do in many ways. So I talked about that. I also gave some suggestions for how to be as skillful as possible looking at the whole area of race and racism. And one of the starting points that I have found extremely useful in trainings I've been part of and in my own mind is to have an understanding that in our society, in every society, there are multiple forms of oppression. And oppression and privilege around race is one form, but there are multiple forms. And there are ways that we have hierarchies around gender, sexual orientation, class, educational level, religion, age, physical ability, and so forth, right? And that generally all of us are at times in the class that we might call oppressed, or the class that is singled out for more negative treatment, even if it's not always conscious, and that some of us are in the upper end of the hierarchy. You know? And so for me, you know, this helps tremendously to think that I can look honestly at race, and my total identity is not that, if I'm a white person, of an oppressor, because there's these multiple forms of hierarchy. And I find that quite important. And the other side of that is that if one's looking at some form of oppression where one is in the oppressed group, or what's sometimes called the group that's targeted for mistreatment or less good treatment, that one's identity is not totally there as well. You know, so none of us are either only oppressor or only oppressed. And I find that very freeing because, again, I can look at things, but this is not the entirety of my identity. And in my experience, this is quite important because it gives a certain amount of freedom to look honestly and to not be so caught up in the difficult emotions which come with looking into these issues, which can often be paralyzing emotions like shame and guilt, activities like self-judgment can be very paralyzing, or really this sort of deep need in a lot of these discussions that we may feel, you may have noticed it in the last week, of wanting to be the good person, wanting to be the morally good white person, or it could be the really good man on gender issues, right? Or, you know, we could go down the list, right? And so there can be a lot of pressure to create what in Buddhist language we would call a significant sense of self. You know, and one, you know, in some of the groups I've been part of, which have been devoted to looking particularly at the conditioning around whiteness, we've had some fun identifying the nature of the white self. what are some of the forms it takes? Well, one form that it sometimes takes is wanting to be the good white self. Have you noticed that? And of course, the flip side of that is not wanting to be identified as the bad white self. And this is a strong pressure, and it actually blocks inquiry when that's strong. And so it's very good to look out at that. So that would suggest this is a charged and difficult area. I gave last time some of the history and historical perspectives on race. I talked about how there are in virtually every culture, there are hierarchies, and there can be groups of people who are singled out for negative treatment. That you can find in every society. It's different. Race is a particular way to do it. You know, it's a particular form. I think it can be useful to go back and to look, something I didn't do so much last time, to look at the Buddha's relationship to the major system of India then as well as now, which is the caste system, right? And many of you know that the Buddha created a kind of counterculture, namely the Sangha, or the community. People left the mainstream society and they joined the community of monks and nuns. And in doing so, they were invited to leave behind their caste, which was definitive of people in that society, and still very much is in India. The Buddha wasn't trying to reform the whole society, but he said, in my community, we don't have caste. So he was taking a pretty radical step. And later, as some of you know, he originally had distinctions of gender which were more conventional. And some of you know the story. He was convinced by Ananda to have nuns in the order. And he agreed after being politicked by Ananda, his assistant, right? And so there was in that community, that is a kind of significant attention to large-scale social issues, right? It's not social reform, but it's social reform within the community. And he was criticized very harshly, as you could imagine. This is the pillar of the society. This is, you know, the justification you can find in the sacred text for caste. Right? You can look at some of the Vedas, and you can find the justification. The Buddha went against that. He gave, in a sense, a very radical teaching. Just a few lines that might be helpful here. No Brahmin, I, no prince, no farmer or aught else, all worldly ranks I know, but knowing I go my way as simply nobody. With shaven crown I go my way alone, serene, to ask my birth is vain. Those who enter the order, another line from the Buddha, lose their previous names and identities and are reckoned as recluses who are sons of Sakya. That's the family name of the Buddha. And this was particularly provocative. By birth, one is not an outcast. By birth, one is not a Brahmin. By deeds alone, one is an outcast. By deeds alone, one is a Brahmin. That was very provocative, you know, to have lines like that. And so we find some, you know, a radical social move at the time of the Buddha, you know. When we fast forward then and look at race, we find that it's a particularly modern way of organizing differences and creating differences. And Last time I gave some outline of how race really originated in the latter part of the 17th century, especially in Virginia, that you had people from Africa who were slaves, although slavery was much more loose at that time. You had people from England who were working, and they were working together, and they were also intermarrying in the middle of the 17th century. And particularly after a rebellion in which the Africans and the white workers got together, the elites developed new laws, basically classical divide and conquer, and they started calling people whites and blacks, which they had not done before. There were people who were born as Englishmen and Christians, and who in one short period then became whites. They did not think of themselves that way until a series of laws were passed and classifications, which basically had the white workers be a kind of buffer between the people of African background and the elites. And they were given certain gifts and privileges. Things became very rigid. There were slave codes that developed. The slave laws became very intense. Slavery became something that could be passed on, that would be passed on to all the children, which wasn't the case before that. And it became very rigid, very harsh. Slaves could be killed without it being a crime. You know, and again, we entered into this period of slavery. And this is really where the concept of race came, white and black came. And, you know, in the 18th century, philosophers developed the concept. And there were a number of attempts to give philosophical justifications, to talk about the, you know, it was very fashionable then to talk about the various races. One of the main writers on race was a German named Blumenbach, who was actually against slavery, but he nonetheless had one of the main typologies. And he was the person who coined the phrase Caucasian, which is named after Mount Caucasus, some of you may know. And he thought, and he, it was based on him noticing a skull that I think, I don't know, turned up in Berlin or something. And he thought that the skull was such a beautiful skull. This must be the place for the most beautiful people. And of course, the people from that area actually, and when they later would try to immigrate to the United States, weren't necessarily seen as whites. But that's another thing. So anyway, there's a lot of irony here, but I think we know that over time this system was incredibly harsh and became the justification for horrors that I think we know. 10 to 15 million people died in the Middle Passage, bringing people from Africa to the United States, and of course we know, I think, many of the horrors of slavery. You know, families were separated, people were basically under a regime of torture. You know, and this lasted for about 250 years. Anthropologists and biologists think that race is totally a social construct. There's no validity to it. There's more genetic difference between two neighbors in Italy than between an Italian and a Korean person. There's no, the concept of race makes no biological sense. It's purely a social construct based on linking certain perceptions. And that's pretty well established. That is not controversial, what I just said, among biologists and anthropologists. So we have this social construction, and as I said last time, I like to think that this social construction, which has been connected with so much suffering, originated at a certain point and will pass away. I think that's a hopeful way to see things. We can remember impermanence. Again, we look to the various horrors. Even after the Civil War, of course, there was a brief opening, a period of reconstruction. African Americans entered the U.S. Congress and entered the political realm, and then the door shut about 10 years later. And political compromise that basically let the South do what it would. The rise of the Ku Klux Klan, lynchings, Jim Crow, and the lack of the will of the federal government to do anything about it, a kind of political compromise, which went on pretty much till the civil rights movement, the modern civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s, which then brought about some further changes, and then, of course, many of those have fallen back, particularly with African Americans. In the last 30 years, again, I won't go into so much of the detail, but that's a narrative, I would suggest. And then we have the figures, which I mentioned last time, which are pretty shocking. 40% of African American kids are in poverty, which is very shocking to say and to hear. 1 out of 3 African American men will have something to do with the criminal justice system during their lives, and so forth. You know, I think we can know that. And I talked about the unequal use of the criminal justice system. This is pretty well known. So what's a practice perspective? What kind of practice perspective might we have towards all of this? And I wanted to give a few perspectives that really, and see if these resonate with you. I'm going to mention 3 or 4 perspectives that come out of the core Dharma teachings that are bases for working with this phenomenon. And it really is to kind of ask, we could ask the question. I think sometimes I find it helpful to ask a historical question, like what would I do if I knew what I know now and I were in Mississippi in 1935? And you had a very, you know, you had a nice, vibrant spiritual practice. Do you think you would feel called to attend to the injustice and suffering around you? You know, more radically, what would you do if you were in Nazi Germany? You know, what would you do if you were really aware of some injustice? And again, it's helpful to look back in history because we would like to think, oh, I would definitely act in Mississippi in 1935, right? We might like to think that, but how different is it now, right? But I think that's a provocative question that can really open something up. So there are a few perspectives. One of them is the perspective of transforming suffering. This is the heart of Buddhist practice, right? It's the first, well, it's really the 4 Noble Truths, right? That our work is to transform suffering. We could ask the question, what suffering do we transform? Do we just transform my personal suffering, or do we transform suffering at large? And I think this is an interesting question. This is from Santi Caro, who some of you know, who was a monk for many years with Ajahn Buddhadasa in Thailand. He said this, in the Buddha's original formulation of the 4 Noble Truths, he neither spoke of my dukkha nor your dukkha. He spoke simply of dukkha. There is dukkha. Dukkha is the word for suffering in the sense of reactivity, some kind of not being okay with the present moment, reacting to the present moment, either by pushing it away or grabbing hold of it. The Buddha said there is dukkha. It is important that we remember this fact and do not overly personalize the 4 Noble Truths such that they become merely a matter of my dukkha and getting rid of my dukkha. Many Buddhists have fallen into this trap, which is the primary reason why many of them are not concerned with the incredible dukkha that surrounds them in the world. This observation helps explain why many so-called Buddhists simply retreat into themselves without participating responsibly in collective efforts to address the dukkha of society. On the other hand, there are many, the do-gooders, who are very concerned with helping others to get rid of other people's dukkha. We find many of these people in the activist world. often they are overly concerned with the dukkha of others to the degree that they fail to look within and see the dukkha that is inside them too. Thus, we must also avoid the trap of your dukkha or their dukkha. We only get confused when we believe that dukkha can be segregated and compartmentalized. So interesting, isn't it? And, you know, it's really an interesting question. How do we work with the suffering that's there from the past? In a sense, we could say all suffering is a residue of the past. You know, all suffering comes from the ignorance that we have. This is traditional teaching that we have sort of inherited from the past. So how do we deal with collective suffering? I'll come back to that, but that's a hard issue. How do we deal with the large-scale collective suffering that's there from the past, or the residues of that? How do we really address social suffering? And how do we do that and really stay grounded in our practice? Another way to look at that is to say the question, to what extent am I really driven by compassion? And to what extent does the existence of suffering related to race and racism, which I have to say is actually the suffering of all of us. One of the suffering of those who are oppressed is sometimes obvious. One of the things that I particularly was struck by being part of a 6-month program of inquiry at East Bay Meditation Center for quote-unquote white people was the level of suffering of the white people. Often, you know, on multiple ways. One level was simply, for a lot of the people, they didn't know who they were. They came to the U.S. and you let go of your old identity. And there was a lot of suffering around that. They said, who am I? And they said, well, you know, I'm a mutt. My ancestry has 8 different European countries behind it. And I don't know who I am. And you could feel it. You could feel the suffering. The person who's a scholar and activist on race named John Powell, who is the director of an institute at UC Berkeley, he says, we give a lot of attention to white privilege, but we often underestimate the degree, we often underestimate the cost of privilege. It's something that you may have found in your inquiry, something I was very, was one of my major findings from this 6-month program, the level of suffering that was there. And it's the suffering of not knowing who one is, but it's also this lingering sense that one is accepting injustice. You know, there can be suffering related to one's own moral sense or one's sense of oneself as a moral person. You know, and I found that also. This is from Michelle Alexander, who wrote the book The New Jim Crow, some of you know, which is a very good book to read to get a sense, particularly of recent developments. Her thesis is that the mass incarceration system has reproduced a lot of the features of the Jim Crow system in the South, where basically people, especially for drug laws, which are unequally enforced, become felons, can't get a job, can't get housing, have very little that can work for them, and go into an underclass where there's not much possible except for maybe becoming a criminal again, which takes them right back. So again, she says that the fact of these residues of race and racism are linked with kind of a failure of compassion in the larger society. So some of us may really want to look at where does our compassion end. She says, it is this failure to care, to really care across color lines, that lies at the core of the system of control in every social caste system that has existed in the United States or anywhere else in the world. A lack of care, or a lack of, we might say, empathy. One of the interesting things to look at is to look at where in our own minds we create others, people who are different than us, whether it's race or class or gender, such that empathy is not there, such that there's some kind of polarization. That's something very important to look at. Where do I create an other? And of course, we create an other of other people, but we also do it to ourselves. We create others of ourselves in certain ways. We also create others of certain parts of ourselves. In other words, we put certain parts of ourselves out of our heart. There's a process. Again, I think the nice language is to call it a process of othering. Tara Brach has a very helpful phrase. She says, when there's a lack of empathy and a lack of compassion, we create unreal others. They're not real for us, in a sense. We don't have that sense of empathy. We don't have that sense of care. And this is something really to look at. Where does that happen for myself? Or where is there empathy? Or how can I cultivate empathy and compassion? I think some of this has to be actively developed. Sit and watch the news and practice empathy. And there are a lot of different ways to practice. I think we practice it sometimes here in the context of wise speech when I've taught here. A lot of it is just saying what's going on for the person, what's the emotion, what matters for this person, and tuning in. So part of this inquiry that I was inviting last time is to watch, where do I create an other of another person? Where does empathy break down? And Michelle Alexander is saying there has to be some massive failure of empathy in the society for 40% of African American children to be in poverty. Again, and we want to look at what are the mechanisms for that. And we could come out of our Buddhist practice and be deeply committed to compassion and say, this is not okay. I want to really be a practitioner of compassion, and I feel drawn to act in some way. You know, whether looking into my own mind and experience more, or responding through action, through material help or whatever. This is Cornel West, who is an African American analyst and activist. He says, what we need is a democratic awakening that says that we care about this suffering, that the racial caste system must be dismantled, that we need a revolution in our warped priorities. Again, how do we respond to these larger structures? Part of the challenge is that we're talking about larger systems, and how do we even get at them? We'll come back to that. Another way we can look at these issues is from the point of view of ignorance. And we know that in the classical teachings, ignorance is the root cause of greed, hatred, and delusion. That ignorance about who we actually are is at the root. And we could say this is an ignorance about our deep brilliance and profound qualities of love and wisdom that we can touch. That there's this very open heart and this wisdom that sees into interdependence. And this is the aim of practice, is to touch that, have that be more in one's life, and to stabilize. And that the core problem is one that we don't really know who we are. And we tend to create a separate self. Again, long-standing conditioning around this, and this is talked about quite often. I've been interested in, some of you have heard these talks, I've given a series of talks on the nature of the self, and did a day long just about a month ago. Is anyone at that day long? Yeah. On the nature of the self, the nature of the teaching of anatta, or not self. And one of the ways of talking about it that I have found helpful is to see that the practice is a kind of thinning of the self, a thinning of the separate self that opens us up to these resources of love and wisdom. And that a major way that we carry out this practice is to see where the self is thick. I use the metaphor of thick and thin. You know, where does the self feel thick? You know, we feel thick when we judge ourselves. We feel thick when we judge another person. We get polarized. Okay, I have a very thick sense of self because, you know, you're wrong and I have zero empathy for you because you're wrong and get with the agenda. You know, or we become thick in our sense of self, often in the places of our wounding, where we're wounded, because we want to protect those places. Very natural. But there's a very thick sense of self. If I have issues of abandonment, I will get a very protective sense of self when that gets triggered, you know, when someone close to me leaves for a while, and so forth. I think we know that. And one of the forms of the thick self that's been very interesting for me is the racialized self. Now, this is tricky because there are forms of the thick self that are hidden, that are not obvious. When I have a wound and I feel really protective, sometimes that's more obvious. When I'm judging, especially with a good amount of mindfulness practice, we kind of know that that's happening, right? But the kind of there are aspects of the thick self that are more hidden. And I've in the work on the nature of the self, I talk about that in two main forms, the psychological dimensions of that and the social dimensions of that. And I won't go so much into the psychological, but I think that around race, there is a very, very thick sense of self, whether we are in the oppressed group or the more the privileged group. You know, and it's way more obvious with the oppression. It's not always so obvious what people have taken in. And often people have to do a lot of inner work to work through that. And some of you have been in women's groups where you've done the counterpart of that around gender issues, right? Where you've talked and you've looked at the conditioning. But the what we could call privilege is hard to see, right? The nature of being on the upper end of a social category is that we're normal and they're a problem. Do you know that one? Right? That in this culture, to be white is to be normal and normative. And we don't have to think about ourselves. And what it means is that the conditioning is rather hidden. And it's hard to get at. We have to do actually active inquiry and looking to actually get at that. And so if we have this really core intention of cutting through the conditioning that makes us ignorant or that takes us out of the heart of love, we would want to look at that conditioning around race. Because that, again, it's not obvious. We don't think we need to look at it, but it's actually very important. A very important this part of this work is to look continually at that level of conditioning. And the last sort of model of practice I wanted to talk about is the model of community or sangha. And really, it goes back to some of what I said earlier, that there is an aspiration in our practice to have the sangha or the community of all beings. We say that in our metta practice, we say that in our dedication of merit. We have an aspiration for all beings. We don't say, may the people only of Marin Sangha be well. Our metta practice is not structured around that, is it? It's really structured. It has a quality of developing that quality of care and love for all beings. And to have that be more and more the default way of being, to have that metta be the way one is for all, that's clearly the horizon of our practice. So it would become very important for us to see, where do I actually have conditioning that makes that hard to have that for certain people? And where, in actuality, is there not a community of all beings? You know, and that question would take us a long way. It would also take us to look at non-human beings, look at the ecosystems and so forth. But in terms of the focus today, it would have us look, where, what is there in my conditioning that makes me unable to really have my heart open in towards certain people? And this will translate, you know, into what makes it, you know, what makes it harder to have people from non-dominant groups be comfortable in a given sangha. We've looked at that a lot at Spirit Rock, for example. A lot of issues there. It's not easy. You know, it's not easy being in a wealthy, predominantly white county, right? There are issues. It's not easy. And you know, we've given many years of reflection. I've been part of that in terms of Spirit Rock, but it's hard. But if for our horizon, one of the forms of action might be to act for my local community, for my place of work, right? To what extent is my place of work really welcoming? To what extent do we have conditioning in my work, in my family, in my school, in my spiritual community? That would be a way of taking this further. So this is big. There's a lot more I could say. I didn't really look too much at my notes. You might have noticed. I have a lot more I could say, but I want to leave time for us to talk together. Maybe just to say that this is a large issue. It can feel overwhelming, but it also can be very practical. Maybe if we take one of those horizons that I mentioned, the horizon of working with ignorance, with working with my own conditioning, who I think I am, or the horizon of community, the horizon of where does my heart shut down? You know, where do I create an other? You know, the horizon of really looking at the response to suffering, the dedication to compassion. See which of those draw one. And maybe that can take us a little bit further. But this is large, and this is, I think, one of the things, maybe I'll close with this. One of the things I learned from Joanna Macy, who is a really beautiful integrator of inner work and responding to the needs of the world, she has a model which is very, very freeing. She says there are three main ways that large-scale systems change, what she calls the great turning. She says, first, there are holding actions to prevent further damage, to stop negative things from happening. A lot of activism fits in that category. Secondly, there is the analysis of our core institutions and the transformations of our institutions. So this might mean working with how this manifests in the schools or in a community. You know, I learned actually that the community I grew up in, Montgomery County, Maryland, this actually happened on a large scale, that there was a superintendent of the schools who had a radical move and wanted to have the entire school system be based on principles of inclusivity, understanding of difference, diversity, and so forth. And he produced a program which was radical and has become written about in a number of books. You know, so this is the changing of the institution, second form. And then thirdly, changing the very nature of consciousness, how we look at things. These are the three forms. And what I think is freeing about that is that all three of them are necessary, but we can ask, where do I feel called? It might be to the first, it might be to the third, or I might want to do a little bit of the first and really focus on the second. But I like that, because that it makes addressing a large system workable. Again, the three are holding actions to prevent further damage, understanding and the institutions and creating alternative institutions, again, all sorts of institutions, and thirdly, looking and shifting the very nature of consciousness on a given issue. And so that and see where one's drawn and see where one's gifts are. And that's another way to make this workable and practical, because that's what we're looking for. Something big like this can just say, oh my God, it's so big, it's so overwhelming. And yet, large numbers of people doing their part is the way actually things change. It's not large numbers of people doing massive amounts where they sacrifice their life to it. It's large numbers of people working, you know, might be, okay, I'm gonna devote 1 or 2 hours a week to this. You have 10 or 15% of the population devotes 1 or 2 hours to this a week, things will change. Thank you. We have some time for discussion, or again, I'd be very interested just to see what people investigated in the last week, what you might have found, any questions. Please, yeah. Let's use the microphone.
Thank you. I really appreciate it a lot. It's, you know, I practice a lot with my automatic responses and trying to bring some sense of space and presence in situations that I feel are threatening, which that can be group situations or situations where I feel there's a power dynamic or yep. whatever, you know. So I practice with that a lot. And to bring this just concept, focus on race or the other, was just a nice new dynamic,
yep.
another place to practice.
Yep.
consciously, and yeah. it was interesting to see how there are many situations where I feel like there's a potential threat. It's just as you say, it's the relic or the residue of my conditioning. And to see that that's heightened even more when it comes to somebody that I perceive as being other. And then to practice with, okay, can I have some space and allow that to be there, but then also allow there to be a possibility for some sort of intimacy or some sort of relationship where my reaction is to push even further away and to protect myself in some way. So it's been a very, very useful and helpful
Thank
practice
you.
This week and very interesting to pay attention to.
Yeah, it's great. And, you know, and again, we can go this, work with this process in 20, 50 different ways, you know. It could be to really, work more closely with someone who is across one of the divisions. You know, I know I worked for 9 years with an African-American woman. We were teaching together in a program for about 9 years. And got very intimate, and we shared, you know, our own conditioning with each other, and you know, and she could say, well, you know, when that happens, that triggered it. Kind of, that triggers stuff, and it kind of feels like it goes back to some of this old slave residue, you know, and we could be very honest and frank with that together. It, you know, the relationship had to be there pretty solid. But that is incredible, right? To really have that intimate discussion, and then I could see what I was taking for granted, what I didn't know in a situation. I didn't know so much that vulnerability that was there. Much more attentive to that now. That's an example, and that can come from simply really working more with a colleague, right? Like that. Yeah. Please, in the back. Why don't we say our names also, so we connect in that way.
My name is Chris. I just noticed that in your talking about changing the institution, changing the nature of consciousness, that in the massive shifts happened in India and South Africa under Gandhi and Mandela, that's where actual consciousness shifted.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed to take a figure, although everybody was doing their part,
yeah,
the figure of these absolute paragons of humanity, Gandhi and Mandela, I don't think there's anybody. We had Martin Luther King in this
country. Yeah, yeah.
But I was just going to say that. And the other thing is, I did read The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander,
yep,
and I recommend it highly. It really is one of the finest books I've read in years. It really takes on a lot of the assumptions, basic assumptions that we have. And I have a bunch of degrees, and I thought, oh, I knew this. No, I didn't know it.
Yeah. Yeah, and the book is The New Jim Crow, and she teaches, we're at Ohio State, I think. And there are also some wonderful YouTube videos of an hour lecture of hers where you could get the whole thesis and have a sense of the energy of the audience and so forth. We heard one of those, Mama. With my mama here. Michelle Alexander. Yeah, so if you just look her up on YouTube, there's some quite wonderful hour-long, talks. But yeah, in terms of the question of the leader, that's a tricky question, isn't it? Yeah. Well, let's just wait till the right person comes around before we... Not that... No, you weren't saying that at all. But I don't know. It may be different in our times. This is a... this country has different traditions than those countries. And we have the traditions of citizen activists, or, active citizens, another way to say it. And it may well be that things can happen without that kind of leader. The kind of leader is tricky, right? Because it can be somewhat disempowering. So I don't know on that question. I would say, I'm aware of the studies that have been done. I think there were studies of the American Revolution. There are studies of situations where large-scale social change occurred, like the ones you're referring to, and to some extent, there's a mathematics of it. It's of when there's a certain percentage of ordinary people who are quite active, that's when things happen. And one needs, I think it was something like 7%. Stanford did some studies of this. And I think it was 7% of the population is quite active on a given theme. And for various reasons, the energy gets mobilized. So, well, let's hope for great leaders and become some of them ourselves. Yeah, please. Let's wait for the mic.
So I've had black friends and I've had friends of a lot of cultures.
Yeah.
But I do find that sometimes when I reach out to try to be friendly to, say, for instance, an African American person, maybe that I've met through work or whatever, and I try to be friends, I notice the hesitation and, from the other side,
yeah,
the lack of trust or that's from their own experience,
right,
their own history. And so it's not always, doesn't always work out, it's
right,
not really possible. What I try to do is just when I do have those opportunities, don't occur as much in Marin, but when I'm elsewhere and I meet, a black person, I'm engaging with them, what I try to do is just be present in the moment,
yeah,
and do what my tendency might not allow me to do if I'm not being conscious. In other words, I think even when we're with black people, we don't even necessarily hold their gaze as long. We look away or, both sides, or we get uncomfortable. Just to be there and to be fully present and to be looking at somebody and not looking away and holding their gaze and like smiling and being comfortable and having that experience so that everybody can walk away and say, oh, this blonde white woman from Marin isn't who I thought she would be.
Yeah.
Or, so that, that stereotype's break down on those one-to-one interactions that occur, that to, in other words, to optimize every interaction and try to at least have those moments where we can break down some of those stereotypes and
yeah.
we can have positive experiences too, you know, I think is important. Even though it may be small, I think those accumulate and have a ripple effect
yeah.
in the world.
Yeah, just to take as a practice to connect as best one can. And your name again?
I'm Zoe, sorry.
Zoe. Yeah. And yeah, and even and to be tracking one's own conditioning, what's going on, and even those issues of really meeting the gaze, there are a lot of tricky issues in there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There is a certain, you know, there can be certain power dynamics with those kind of with really, you know, having a direct gaze. So there's some tricky issues there.
Of course.
Yeah. But yeah, I think just somehow meeting people, especially if there might be, you know, again, I live in Berkeley and there are certain people I regularly see, and just to somehow to connect. But yeah, I think the spirit of what I'm hearing sounds really, really important. Yeah, thank you. Right, I think right in front of you.
Hello, my name is Kathleen.
Hi.
And I really appreciate the homework.
Oh, great.
There's like two phases. One is my own life, everyday life, you know, where I go to Safeway, I do different things, or I go to Andy's Market. And then there's my life where I work, where I do a lot of customer service, but I deal with the problems.
Mm-hmm.
So other works.
Yeah.
And so it was really beautiful, actually, to have a tool that let me touch, oof, there's other. It just happened. You know, and then later think about how did the other
right.
happen.
Yeah.
You know, that was actually quite beautiful. So I thank you. The other flip to that was I started getting a little excited and said, okay, then what's sane? So then, even though at my work, some of it has to do with difficulties,
mm-hmm.
I get to also greet people. And so it was wonderful to say same and try to come from
mm-hmm.
no difference, or try, whatever
mm-hmm.
that meant, and then greet people.
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt like my mind, mostly my heart, opened a little bit more
right.
on both sides.
Right.
I didn't say great, but you know,
mm-hmm.
because it's like it was new territory. I had never really thought.
Yeah, very fundamental inquiry. You know, this tracking where there's a sense of other. You know, I think even that may be more accessible even than just focusing on race, like really seeing where is there a sense of other? Where does it feel thick? And just really tracking again with this, I didn't say it this time, but I like the line that says, I am not to be blamed for my conditioning, but I am responsible for my conditioning. That's the distinction, right? Yeah, I have received this. I didn't ask for a lot of what I get. I would never have wanted to have a lot of what I've got, you know, in the conditioning, but I can take responsibility for it. It's the core of our practice. We take responsibility for our own minds and our own hearts. And it sounds very rich. And while I'm thinking about that, there was a wonderful conference, which I don't know if anyone here went to, on the theme of othering and belonging. Anyone go to that? Did you? Yeah. It was in Oakland in the spring. It was called Othering and Belonging. It was the main organizers was this man, John Powell, John, I think, A. Powell, that I mentioned earlier. He was a beautiful man. And the videos for that conference are online and accessible. And there are, you know, amazing series of people addressing these issues. A lot of them from the point of view of spiritual practice, quite a few Buddhist practitioners. Joanna Macy was there, Bell Hooks, some of you know, Buddhist practitioner, quite a number of social scientists talking about, you know, implicit bias and that sort of thing, and some very wonderful people. So that is a great resource if you want to take this further. That's one. And I promised to give like a resource list, which I didn't do. So I'm going to have to send it and get it onto the Marin Sangha website. So,
what was that name again, though? Of those
Othering and Belonging.
Okay.
It's a conference, so if you just probably can get it right away, right now.